This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the results, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app and you'll get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of My Argyle Life, the series in which we take a deep dive into the lives and stories of those among us on the terraces of Home Park and across the country, or in this case, the world. Joining us this time is the Brit Award-winning drumming extraordinaire, that is Chris Wood, more affectionately known as Woody. How are you, mate?
I'm very good, thank you, mate. And the checks of the post for that intro as well.
Basically, just kick us off then, usual one, as they say on the terraces, who are you?
I am one quarter of a little known British indie band called Bastille, from Plymouth originally, moved to London seeking fame and fortune, now living in Brighton. We've got two kids as well who, I'm making them be Argyle fans. They're the only kids at the playground wearing Argyle shirts at the minute, despite being in a sea of blue and white shirts everywhere else. Long-suffering Argyle fan, but wouldn't change it for anything.
Yeah, nice. This isn't actually the first time we've spoken. I'm not sure that you'll remember, but we actually caught up briefly, stood in a gazebo, drinking warm beer outside of the away end at Wickham's Adam Park. I think that's the game that you were on the drum. I could be wrong.
It was, yeah. Sadly, couldn't do enough to alter the result because, That whole playoff experience was pretty chastening, to say the least.
Let's start with Argyle first, then. What are your earliest memories of heading down to Home Park? I believe it's more of a family affair for yourself.
Yeah, so my dad, and my uncle, they were taken down to Home Park, but my granddad, since they were like 5 or 6, dad did the same with me. So I'm pretty sure my first home game was Blackburn in the 92-93 season. I think we lost 3-2. Although I'd have been about 5 at the time. But my first full season was 93-94. Peter Shilton's Nearly Men. It was obviously quite an exciting season to kind of get into it regularly. But yeah, I was sort of a football obsessive, really, from like that point onwards. And yeah, it was like me and dad and Gran sat first of all in the old family enclosure, as was, and then moved around to the Lyndhurst.
Naturally, obviously, people know a lot about you and how Bastille came to such prominence. So we can go over that certainly, but what we really want to know is the kind of the unique stories, if you like, the unique perspectives of following Argyle that other supporters wouldn't necessarily have. So just going through kind of chronologically, if we can. So obviously through Peter Shilton and obviously the Nearly Men, then there was the season of relegation down into the League Two and promotion back under Neil Warnock. So going through school, if you like, you must have been, you know, seeing some of the worst ever Argyle years, sort of languishing at the bottom of League Two. You must have been one of the only Argyle fans around at that time, because we weren't getting many in the gates, were we?
Yeah, I remember very clearly we were home to Hereford in the 94-95 relegation season. And yeah, but as you say, bottom of the table, cold Tuesday night, 2-0 down. Can't have been more than 2,000 in the ground. And like dad had me sort of like huddled under his coat. I was shivering. And he's like, "Do you just want to go?" I was like, "Nah, we don't leave." I remember that very clearly. So as far as that kind of like low points go, obviously the administration seasons, that's pretty pretty bleak. But so, yeah, sorry. So, yeah, chronologically, obviously, yeah, 93, 94 was my first full season. Obviously, losing to Burnley 3-1 in the playoffs. And then, yeah, relegating the following season. And then Neil Warnock arriving to turn things around. So that was obviously first sort of taste of promotion and like success and getting to go to Wembley and all that sort of thing. So I'd have been like 10, I think, at the time. And that was the whole sort of family day out. Like my mum never comes to football, but she came that day. Yeah. So yeah, my mum, my sister, like all my cousins. Yeah, it was a massive family turnout for that one.
I wasn't there when I was only 3 years old, but my dad was there. And from what I've heard, we outnumbered Darlington about 4 or 5 to 1 that day in terms of supporters.
Oh, God, yeah. It was like, yeah, night and day. I mean, to be fair, I think we actually took more the last couple of times we've been. But so we were there. Ronnie Mulgé leapt like a salmon, obviously to head it in and score that iconic goal and send us up, which obviously was the last time Argyle won at Wembley, or in fact, scored at Wembley.
Yeah, scored at Wembley. I mean, we won't talk about the last two visits too much, don't worry.
No. That's pretty bleak. And then, from there on in, as I say, obviously, growing up in Plymouth, like, so Dad took me most weeks to home games. Like, we're season ticket holders from then until I left for uni when I was 19. So that's the 2004 historic season. And then... Yeah, my sort of Saturdays were sort of spent playing for a Railway Beacon, as was in the old DJM, and then basically running across Central Park, still like muddy as hell, tracksuit on, and then straight into Argyle to watch the game. So that was that was my Saturday for a good few years.
Yeah, I remember back in the day, I never played DJ myself. I've got two left feet, but a lot of my mates were the same. There was that sort of universal experience of kind of running in after a game. I think they then moved a bit earlier, didn't they, later on to avoid that clash. But touching on that then, as I kind of alluded to earlier, I'm 30. So when I was just starting to go, I was 7 and 8 years old. It was when Forsterick first came in and things became so successful. Then we had the championship years, Ian Holloway. I don't know if you ever noticed, there seems to be a bit of almost a generation gap of Argyle fans. People in their kind of 20s now going into 30s, you can't find enough of them, but people who are kind of now in their late 30s, early 40s, we seem to have so few in number of those fans. And I think it really is probably because of the fact that the 90s years were really kind of the late 90s, certainly were the doldrum years for Argyle, weren't they? And did you find that your experience, like going up through school, that there weren't many other Argyle fans around or not really?
Yeah, there was always a few Argyle fans around. I was probably one of the more diehards, like actually bothering to buy the kit, wear wear the shirt and that sort of thing. But I mean, I still say it now. I'll get pelters for this, but I don't care. There were more Argyle fans, I think, in Plymouth. Sorry, there were more Man U fans in Plymouth than I think were in like Salford at the time when I was like school,
sure,
like primary
that.
School. It's a sea of Man U shirts everywhere. I was slightly odd one out being the Argyle fan. So you were struggling now. There's a fair hefty dose of Schadenfreude going on at the minute with that.
Footballing world feels that, don't they?
Yeah, they do. But I mean, I don't blame anyone for not going, because the sort of standard of football wasn't amazing. Obviously, everyone only had a limited amount of cash at the time to spend. So obviously, going up twice in three seasons under Sturrock, that's going to pull in a lot more fans and convert a lot of people when it's that exciting. Then playing in the Championship as well, people get more accustomed to a sort of higher level of football.
They absolutely do. Go on, Aaron.
I was going to say, just take it back to your comment about the DJM. What are you like as a player? Did you ever come close to living the dream? I've seen your name pop up a couple of charity games, but
yeah, no, I wish that was never a remotely serious aspiration. I still play now. I still play like 5-a-side, 6-a-side most weeks, and like, I love it for the fun. But I had one appearance in a charity game, a game for Grenfell in like 2017-18, for QPR, which is just surreal, because then I'm in the changing room. My peg was in between Damien Duff and Peter Crouch. And I was like, what the hell am I doing here? I'm so far out of my depth. And amongst a bunch of other people. And then yeah, didn't disgrace myself. Played a nice little dink pass to Paul Merson, but then got absolutely skinned by James Bay. So, you know, yeah. Light and shade. But yeah, other than that, no, I mean, I sort of played pretty regularly, like all through school. And then moved to London, and as I said, trying to do music. And then there's a kind of a few times where I'd be playing with my cousin down in New Malden in South London, where I'd say finish work, come in, play football, and then like had a scaffolders had a really, really crap day at work and just tries to snap you in two. Mm. For anyone who doesn't know, to play drums, you need all four limbs intact. So I had to sort of knock that on the head for a while because, yeah, I could really do without a broken leg.
Taking this sideways then, I know Sam's keen to talk about Argyle, but have you played any like musicians tournaments? Are there anybody that you know of that are like would have made it pro?
We been invited a few times, but we're just always on tour, like the Soccer Sixes and that sort of thing when that was happening. I mean, the sort of five-a-side lot that I play with now down in Brighton, it's a mixture of kind of like a load of Brighton musicians, so like the lads in like Architects and Royal Blood and Yumi at Six and Excerpts and like, yeah, countless other bands. So it's kind of, it's a pretty good standard. Sam, the singer from Architects, is just a machine. Like his finishing is like frightening. Like anytime he gets the ball, it's just going top bins. But it's nice because, yeah, everyone there is either band or crew. So they know not to go diving in on like if he tackles and that sort of thing, people will jump out rather than go jumping in. Because, yeah, everyone would like to maintain their livelihoods, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, sounds good. Go on, yeah. Sam. I'll let you take it back.
Yeah, well, no, I was going to say, I don't think you're the rest of the band would be too happy if you injured yourself playing football and missed a tour, would they? It's definitely for the best to be on the safe side. So going into uni, and you kind of alluded that you went to London to do music. Is that something you always wanted to get into the music industry then from a young age? Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I played drums since the age of 11. And my dad is still a guitarist and singer, like in and around Plymouth. So I grew up around sort of pub bands and that sort of thing. And my first ever gig happened because his drummer, Rog, this is back in the days when not everyone had a mobile, forgot they had a gig, went to Tesco's, couldn't be reached. So everyone's kind of sat in the pub at about 10 to 9 saying, "Where the hell's Rog?" So then my dad's mate gave me a lift back home, sort of grabbed my really crappy starter drum kit at the bedroom, set it up and just had to blag the gig basically on the spot. So that's kind of where it started. And then, yeah, I've just always been drawn to music. And it's like the thing that, I mean, say I've got kids now myself, like often you have to tell them to do stuff and please do that, please pick that up. But I didn't have to ever be told to practice drums or work on it. I just wanted to do it. So I've been that way since I was 11, pretty much. So yeah, there was only one way I was really going to go, I think, and that's definitely music.
Absolutely. So going on then, obviously you went to university, you followed Argyle through university, and then talk us through the, and I know this is probably something you're probably fed up of telling everybody you've been asked so many times, but talk us through the circumstances that led to Bastille coming together and kind of their rise to prominence. How did that happen?
So the abridged version is I was broke. I was working temp jobs in the daytime, doing music in the evening. This is around 2008, up in London, living hand to mouth. And I said to Dad at the time, like, I can't manage to... But I was basically like leading two lives in as much as doing music by evening, working in the daytime. So I had to find a way of being able to make money from music. So he suggested, why don't you try teaching drums? So me and him did a drop of around 1,000 flyers all around Wimbledon. I got, to do 1,000 flyers, got 3 phone calls, 2 for lessons, and 1 from some weird kid who lived about 3 roads away, and that happened to be Dan, who's now our singer and songwriter in the band. So he was playing solo at the time, doing a lot more left field, sort of weirder stuff, and me and him played together for 2 years and sort of cut our teeth and, like, yeah, did all the sort of real donkey work about, like, playing to empty pubs, but meeting people along the way. We picked up Will, our bass player, and then come 2010, we needed one more person, which ended up being Kyle, our synth player, to kind of complete the band, at which point Dan had written a whole bunch of new, slightly more poppier songs, which became the first Bastille songs. And then we sort of launched that in 2010. And sort of it looked like we appeared out of nowhere, but we'd done all the groundwork previously under a sort of different guise. So, yeah, hit the ground running. And then we ended up signing with Virgin Records in Christmas of 2011. And then that was the sort of starting point from there. Put out a few singles, put out the album, Bad Blood, which went to number one out of nowhere. Like, no one saw that coming, not even the label. And then Pompeii sort of followed about 6 months later. And then that was the sort of rocket ship we ended up having to cling on to for about 18 months. And that song basically took us around the world, like, 10 times over.
Yeah.
And
that must have been a real moment of kind of, wow, I've really, really made it at this point, yeah?
It was a little bit, but then there wasn't, like, one moment where it sort of happened. It's like there was so much happening at the time simultaneously that there wasn't, like, one thing you could go, but I said, like, say that in the space of a week, like, seven or eight things would happen, which, like, if one of those happened in a year, you'd be like, oh my God, that was mental. But it was, yeah, it was sort of bewildering almost, just how much was happening. But yeah, obviously enormously grateful. And yeah, I'm saying, I'm talking to you now from Dubai. We did a festival here last night. So yeah, the band's still going strong. Although we are about to take a whole year off now. So we've got one more thing, end of the week, and then, yeah, that's us off the road for a year.
So where are you off to next then? Where are you closing out?
Flying to Singapore tomorrow for a thing I cannot tell you about on camera, but I'll tell you when we stop recording. But yeah. But after that, then it's year off, back home, and then start writing album 5 and recording that. And then the circus starts all over again.
Amazing. Sorry, I cut across you there. You were going
to
say something.
No, it's all right. I'm used to that. No, I was just going to say a whole year off. That sounds like an awful lot of Arnold games that you're going to fit into.
I've got a few booked in already, yeah. As I say, also got a wife and two kids who need me at home as well, so I can't just go charging off to every game, sadly, but I'll get to a few. But yeah, I also want to try and stay married if I can.
Yeah, no. Have you taken your kids along? Are they Argyle fans, or are they, I know you said,
I have, yeah,
about them, you know, being in a city full of Brighton fans, but
yeah, I've taken eldest to 3 now. He's seen us beat Ipswich twice, 2-1 at home. Nice. And then I took them both to Lincoln, where we lost 2-0 last season, like one of the rare home defeats. And it was pretty cold. I think the youngest wasn't vibing it too much. But I mean, they're like 8 and 6 at the minute, so still fairly young. But yeah, every time I'm home, like Christmas time and that sort of thing, I always take them with dad as well. So yeah, very much keeping it the family. And yeah, they actually asked for Argyle shirts for their birthdays recently as well. So yeah, that's kind of without too much pressure, I think, from me. So yeah, hopefully the indoctrination's working gradually.
Yeah, obviously I know
it's a tough ask, isn't it? In a city doing as well as Brighton, but it sounds like you're doing a cracking job at it.
I'll try.
Yeah.
Obviously, I know from living away from Plymouth that I feel more of an affinity with the club and the city as a whole, when you live away. Do you find that when you go to like away games, or I suppose like having a higher profile as well, you must be spotted an awful lot, but like going to away games feels different when you live away from the city.
It definitely does, yeah. I mean, especially when I went to uni, first of all, so obviously leaving home for the first time, and Argyle are doing well, there's like a sort of big sense of pride there, because like people actually like have heard of your team, which isn't always a given. But yeah, I think, yeah, I like chatting to a lot of people who, I mean, as I'm sure you've done the same, there's like a lot of people end up having to leave Plymouth to go and seek like other career opportunities and whatnot, so a lot of people end up moving away. But then it's amazing who you bump into like at the away games, and everyone's all scattered around the country now. But yeah, it's, I mean, I think for the hardcores who travel from Plymouth for every away game, then like just the kudos to them, because the mileage they're racking up is just absolutely unbelievable. And yeah, like get spotted occasionally, but everyone's generally quite nice and polite, so there's no real bother.
Yeah, good.
Probably just a bit, yeah. Probably a bit gutted that Josh Willigan was not there instead, but yeah, I'll have to make do.
We were putting bets on who was going to lead the trophy out at Wembley last season, and obviously your name and Josh's was mentioned an awful lot. Did you ever get the call?
I did, but then someone sent me a picture of one of the Chuckle Brothers on the back of a Papa John's motorbike, so I figured that wasn't going to do the street cred too much help. I thought I'd pass on that one.
I think you'd look good on a little Vespa, personally, but
It's so going back to kind of what you said about some crazy humbling moments, Woody, when Bastille were really coming to prominence around 2013, 2014 kind of time, how did it feel to have your song Pompeii played as the Argyle goal music for a brief time around that era? That must have been quite a special moment.
I mean, I loved it, obviously, because I'm a diehard Argyle fan, but I was also very conscious, like, I didn't want the club ramming it down people's throats too much, so that just so as to make everyone sort of sick of us. But yeah, I guess if it's a sort of a Pavlov's dog association of hearing the song and thinking we've scored, then yeah, it's probably not terrible.
Was that in the same period that the Port Isaac's Fishermen's Friends were played at before the game? Argyle the reason
later, I think.
Are Argyle the reason that two of the best bands from the West Country like shot off to prominence?
Yeah, I'm sure they can claim a little bit of credit. Although I have technically played at Home Park, allegedly played, because I don't know if you saw the Pilgrim Pete playing drums on the Argyle socials.
We were going to ask about that a little later in the pod. How did that come about then? We were about to ask about that. That must have been quite a surreal experience.
I'm sort of friendly with people at the club, and they sort of asked me, think I'd say no. I was like, I'll do it. Managed to tie it in with a home game. So then it's sort of a two birds, one stone situation. I can report that the inside of that head absolutely fucking reeks. Like I was smelling that on my hair for a full week afterwards. Like I was like scrubbing it, basically bleaching it. There's deep nastiness going on in there. But it's quite fun to do, but I hadn't quite fathomed how tricky it would be to play drums with essentially a small sofa like strapped to your head. Because you just couldn't see anything.
The thing I loved most about that little incident is it showed that Argyle, the way we are now, being a successful as we are now, we're not afraid to kind of have a laugh at ourselves, if you like, as a club, because there was all the...
Yeah.
I don't know if you're the background of it, there was a lot of memes and tweets about, you know, announced the new Argyle and massive chocolate bars, and the fact that they went to the effort of getting you to come and put on a Pilgrim Pete costume and drum the intro to that song to announce the Argyle and massive chocolate bars is I think a good representation of where we are as a club these days. I think it's fantastic.
They informed the head groundsman, they didn't inform all the ground staff, so one of them came from a different corner. Like, what the bloody hell's that drum kit doing on my fucking pitch, right? I went, mental. understandably so.
Well, it was worth it for the entertainment. It gave so many Argyle fans. It was quite some moment, I have to say. So I mean, going back to the sort of the chronology of it, if you like, with Argyle and Bastille, it must have been a bit of a surreal experience, because just as Bastille were kind of absolutely, spiraling into being the world known band they are now, Argyle were kind of having some of their darkest times, weren't they? And then it was at the point whereby, we were struggling at the bottom end of League Two. And, I mean, how did you kind of find that era from an Argyle point of view when we were, you know, struggling to stay in the league year on year?
I think that obviously that period was bleak, but there's a lot of sort of good has come out of that pain ultimately, in terms of. Like first James Brent, and now, like if it hadn't been for that period, we wouldn't have Simon Hallett now. I think it's phenomenal, and I mean we'll talk about it later. But like I've had the chance to hang out with him quite a bit, and like I really rate him. But just to see the state of clubs now, Reading and Wigan and teams that are gone, like Macclesfield and Bury, like just how close we came to complete annihilation. The fact that we still have the club, we still own the ground. And it's thriving. Like I just feel so grateful for what we have. So yeah, some of the results aren't going away at the minute, but we're still playing good football, and I think it will come good. But also I think you just sort of learn to appreciate like what we have. Like the club is still surviving and thriving, and it obviously represents the city, and for people like us who live away, like what that means. The fact that it survived, it just kind of, yeah, I think it's maybe a bit of a reality check of just kind of how much the club actually means to everyone. So yeah, that period was bleak, it was horrible. I'm glad we're through it, but maybe yeah, in hindsight, it wasn't all bad ultimately.
I completely agree. Going back to myself, that was actually my university days. So my university days weren't so proud to boast about Argyle as yours were, really. It was a bit of a sort of a embarrassed smile when I mentioned I supported Argyle back in those days. But the wins. As they have this season, the wins felt all the more special for being a bit further between, you know. The fact that it wasn't, you know, and absolutely amazing as the last two seasons have been, and I don't seek to denigrate them in any way. The kind of regulation wins, the kind of, you know, 1-0 at home, 2-0 at home, they didn't feel so special because you began to gradually expect them. And in those seasons where we weren't winning so much, as bleak as they were, I think the joys, like kind of a saying you said earlier, light and shade, the joys came from those moments. I remember a day at Aldershot when Jason Banton scored twice to propel us
into
the relegation zone at that time. It was just an absolutely great day. And and another one that comes to mind that same season, a Tuesday night at Southend, when Paul Watson scored his, I think, possibly his second goal after coming back to the club. Just those small moments make it feel all the more brilliant. Going on to kind of the revival then, James Brent then going on to Simon Hallett, the promotions under Derek Adams. Obviously, talk to me about that, Eric, because we all know Wembley was a very gloomy day, but generally, it was, how refreshing was it? You know, I know I certainly felt, as I'm sure you did too, to see a team playing with confidence, with sort of swagger again, to see a team that looked like they knew what they were doing was refreshing, wasn't it?
Yeah, massive. And also, sorry, I sort of failed to say earlier, like, obviously, James Brent sort of helped lead the whole thing, but obviously, Chris and everyone, like, the Argyle Fans Trust and all the Argyle staff who went, like, unpaid for months, like, still deserve a massive pat on the back, like, even to this day, because, yeah, if they hadn't done what they did, the club wouldn't have survived. But, yeah, so, yeah, going back, yeah, up that season, I was on a mate's stag do in Zante when we beat Pompey to go to win the semi-final in this just like abandoned sports bar. Basically, we're the only ones on the whole island who gave the remotest shit about watching the game. So me and seven mates went mental watching Peter Hartley nod it in at the end. And yeah, as you say, like, swagger is the thing. Like, actually looked like a team that wanted to play under John Sheridan as well. That Wembley game, we just didn't turn up. It was a strange one. But yeah, I remember when Hiram Boateng came back as well, everyone thought, oh, that's going to be like the sort of missing linchpin that's going to pull it all together and see us over the line. And then, yeah, that Wembley final was just long and just no one really managed to pull it together. But
yeah, I kind of had a feeling, because it was so many times that season where we, as good as we were, we did give ourselves false hope. We won two great games in a row, and then we were kind of shocking in the next game. I think it was kind of, I guess, to an extent, the growing pains of becoming a good team again after years of being, you know, so far from that. But it was it was a gutting day. But as you say, that era as a whole was incredible. Were you at Liverpool for the game there at Anfield?
I was, yeah. I was there for that. Seeing Sonny Bradley put his finger in Emre Can's ear, amongst other things. That was just a ridiculously fun day. Just being in the way end, just chatting, we're just too good for you, all that sort of thing. Obviously, tongue firmly in cheek. And also, if actually the season before that, I did my first stint with Sparksy as well, like, on BBC Devon.
Yes, how was that then? Which,
that was so I've been very fortunate with the band. We've played to obscenely huge crowds, toured the world, and I do it in a relatively relaxed manner. That is the most stressed out and nervous I've ever been in my life. Just trying not to repeat yourself, to say something of vague intelligence, not to say all the time, and not to swear, all whilst the studio are chatting away in your ear. But I miss Sparksy a lot, because he was just world class. I think somewhat shamefully was probably overlooked by BBC. I think he should have been doing Five Live. He should have been hosting like talk shows. Maybe there's a little bit of bias because of his regional accent, but I thought he was an absolutely top quality broadcaster. So yeah, very sorely missed.
No, I think that's a very fair point. And I think possibly he was just maybe born a bit too early, because I think in later years, the BBC have done a lot more to bring people in with regional accents. And I think that's not just out of a, you know, token or whatever. It's because I think they were, as you kind of alluded to, they were very much overlooking regional accents before. And I think now they're kind of readdressing that balance slightly. But I couldn't agree with you more. He was a fantastic commentator and an even better man. He would just have time for absolutely everybody. He would... I remember when I was young, back in the kind of Paul Stewart, when I was 8 or 9 years old, going with my dad I would always on the away games that I didn't attend listen to him on the radio, and I remember getting very excited at a game at Colchester at the Old Layer Road, as it was back in 2002. Seeing Sparksley, it was almost, you know, more exciting than if I'd seen one of the players. Yeah. You know, he was that level of legend. He was absolutely one of our greatest ever, and it was obviously so sad to lose him so prematurely. On that commentary, though, I mean, I can't imagine from your point of view how that must have been, because even going on this podcast, I can stumble over my words, and it's fine because Aaron can edit it out, and I can just use and abuse him for that. But going on there live, when you know that one slip of the tongue, could embarrass you, or it might have to cut it out, or I couldn't do it. I think you're a better man than me for doing it. I think I would just get too nervous to do it. But I guess it's something that you gradually settle into over time, and it becomes a bit more normal.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think I did it with Sparksy four times in the end, but such was the kind of level he was operating at. He would often, like, underarm, like, nice little easy things for you to say, just like the way he would ask questions or bring things up. So he would basically make you sound a lot more informed than you really were. Also, having the studio chatting in his ear constantly, and he's making notes. He's literally like multitasking on a whole other level, and also looking after his summariser as well. So, yeah, I think a massive talent that is sorely missed.
Yeah, and going into with the kind of with you sort of getting to know the players and people around the club. I mean, how was that feeling? Because I think with every football fan, there's an element of them that's still kind of a bit of an inner child when it comes to meeting sort of representatives of their team. I remember, I'm sure Aaron won't mind me saying that when he mentioned about nearly bumping into Joe Edwards at a service station and being starstruck. I think that was you, Aaron. I apologise if someone else told me that story. But that might be it, but maybe somebody else is Joe Edwards. But I guess it's true, isn't it, for all football fans that when you are meeting players or managers or representatives of your club, there's a bit of you that sort of turns back into a sort of 9-year-old again. It's but I guess the more that's gone on, the more you just, I guess, you sort of stop seeing them as players and start seeing them as your mates. Is that kind of how it goes to you?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, I mean, I'm friendly with a handful of them, and there's a lot of crossover with say like music and sport in terms of your profession's kind of performed in front of a lot of people. You're under public scrutiny. You need to perform consistently every time you go out there. Like a lot of traveling as well, and like I guess that whole 10,000 hours thing is like everyone's gone on a similar journey, just in a different industry, obviously, but. Mm. Well, I mean, obviously, if footballers drank the amount that people in bands do, I don't think they'd be very good footballers. But yeah, there are still a lot of similarities. But I guess it's just that whole pressure of having to perform in front of people. I guess there's a bit of kind of solidarity or mutual respect there, I suppose.
Absolutely. And just sort of wrapping up the chronological side, after which we'll take a quick break, and then we've got a few sort of quick fire other questions after. The recent years under initially Ryan Lowe and then Stephen Schumacher. I mean, I think as brilliant as the Sturrock era was for me as a very young child at the time, and as brilliant as the Derek Adams era was for me as a kind of young man at the time, I think this has just completely blown all of it out of the water. I think the level of connectivity between the club and the fans under Schumacher and Hallett, you know, yes, this season have been a little tough so far. I mean, who knows, by the time of listening, we could have run one, two or three in a row, and this could all sound daft, but, you know, It's just you kind of feel as though whatever happens this season, the club have earned so much credit, haven't they? Because of the brilliant job they've done in kind of getting the club functioning off the pitch, getting it functioning on the pitch, and having that really inbuilt feeling of connectivity. How optimistic do you feel about Argyle's progress and how far they can go under Hallett and Schumacher, Woody?
I mean, I feel enormously positive. I mean, Simon's not a successful businessman by accident. And I think half of that comes from like knowing when to delegate. And you just see, I mean, I've been around the club for years and you see the difference now in the sort of backroom area, like with the corporate stuff. Like it used to be a pretty ramshackle affair. Now it's really slick. Like Andrew Parkinson, like helping to like run the club, like really professionally, like to a very high standard. And that all sort of leadership sort of trickles down from the top. And then onto the pitch as well. Backing the manager, letting him kind of be a bit bolder, and also just all the recruitment. I think to me it looks like anyway that we're going to be kind of maybe moneyballing it a little bit, kind of like Brighton and Dortmund, where I suspect we're going to lose a few popular players, but you can rest assured the club have probably already got their replacements lined up, and probably the replacement for them as well subsequently. So as long as the club just keeps on moving forward and sustaining itself, that's the thing. Like, the Championship as the league is an absolute basket case. You've got like teams losing like £100,000 a week, which obviously we couldn't sustain. So as I said earlier, obviously just being grateful to have a club that is thriving. I can live with a few players getting sold and moved on as long as they get replaced. I mean, hell, maybe we are going to be a sort of Championship Brighton, and we're just going to be the stepping stone where we can bring really exciting players through, enjoy them for a while, make money, reinvest at the club. And again, like upgrading the academy, that's a massive step as well, because we've probably lost a lot of young talent locally to Exeter over the years. And you've seen what they've done with Ollie Watkins and Ethan Ampadu and players like that, who now we can compete on that level with the academy. So I think the sort of long-term future for the club is bright, but it's also quite clear. You can see the sort of roadmap they're going down, and it's not based on like boom and bust, just chucking a ton of money for a couple of seasons, hope for the best. And because we can't ever have a repeat of that whole New World Consortium with the Japanese investors and whatnot. That was just disaster politics. Disaster capitalism. Almost sorry. As long as the club is runs like safely and smoothly, then I'm enormously happy.
Obviously, you've been known to bump into Simon Hallett before and after your gigs, especially your tour of the US. I suppose this is a two-part question. In what's it like to have at least what appears to be anyway like a close friendship with Simon? And secondly, are there any lessons from like the world of music that you've learned and passed on to Simon at all?
I consider him a mate. He's very generous with his time and insight, and he's just I can't stress enough, just when you meet the guy, like as a long-term and often suffering Argyle fan, like we're in really good hands at the minute, so long may it continue. Even if results aren't going the right way or whatever, like the club has been run really well, which we should be very, very grateful for. And as far as tips, so he came down to, so we were out in the US with Duran Duran earlier this year, and he came to the show in Philly where he lives, and he hadn't really seen that side of the curtain before in terms of like at an arena show, the logistics, the number of people running around, the staging, all the different jobs. And like, I think it opened his eyes, obviously they're looking to do a lot more concerts at Home Park, and just maybe the sort of limitations or the requirements that they may need to actually bring in to help facilitate that more in the future. Maybe that was helpful. As far as running a football club versus a touring band, it's pretty much a chalk and cheese sort of affair.
No, fair enough. On that then, obviously you've managed to tick off Powderham Castle and the Plymouth Pavilions. How long until the big one, a gig at Home Park?
Oh, I'd love to do it. A lot of stars need to align. Mm. And as I've explained this to people at the club as well, just to kind of like, they know we're interested. It's, we need to be out on a campaign at the time, because if you just do a gig from a standing start, you need to pull all the roadies back in, get all the gear out, get it all done, sort production, that sort of thing. So the sort of startup cost for a tour is like, it's enormous. So if we did it as a standalone thing, we'd probably end up going bankrupt. So it needs to be during a campaign to actually pull it off. Coupled with, there's a 3 or 4 week window in the summer where they can do gigs, because obviously they need to relay the pitch and all that sort of thing. And that needs to not clash with festivals as well, because then there's often like a no-compete clause in terms of like distance or like time in a certain territory. There's a few stars need to line up, but the willingness is definitely there. Just need to sort of shake our crystal ball a few more times and see if the stars do actually line up.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Picture the scene. All of your mates around, you've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Partner this with your team playing champagne football. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. There's nothing quite like a McDelivery. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Just like that. Magic. We're back.
There you go. Bosh.
We've given you, obviously, some quick homework to do. Hopefully you've done that. But I know you're a busy man, but obviously basically just going to summarise your Argyle supporting history in a way that you'll be very familiar with, a chart countdown. We're starting with the top five, top three.
Not as many as top 40, I should make you aware.
Yeah, Jesus Christ, yeah. Beer all day, yeah.
If it was worst moments, but I reckon we could fit 40 in, but over the years. Obviously just your top five worst Argyle moments. So in at five.
I'm trying to think of the very, very worst one. I'm going to put it bottom of the five because it was kind of funny at the same time. It's when we were, this is in the first championship days, away at Birmingham when they were flying high. They had Nicholas Bentner on loan. Mm. We were losing 3-0 and the chant starts going around the away end. Let's pretend we scored a goal. And the ball goes out for a throw-in and the entire away end just explodes. People like throwing seats and all sorts of stuff. The players just stopped. They think, what the hell are they doing? So, yeah, although it was a bad moment, it was kind of a funny one. There's so much history, so I've just gone on. My first real taste of, like, Argyle sort of heartbreak was that Burnley playoff semi-final at Home Park in 94. Lost 3-1, and we had a really good season, and it was just like, having believed that we were going to go up, just getting the rug pulled on you. It was like, oh, that's what sport's all about, is it? It can be really cruel at times.
Are you similar to most then in the fact that, you know, Burnley, you just can't stand them?
Oh, just a complete bogey team. Mm. Always have been. And Turf Moor has always been a graveyard for us as well, since like time immemorium. And then probably Papa John's final wasn't great. A very, very chastening 4-0 drubbing.
It would have been better if you were on that moped, though, right? That would have made your day.
Oh, yeah, could have been. Okay. Could have nicked it. Top worst two. The Wickham playoffs, just overall, that was just having... Yeah, again, it's that sort of false dawn, isn't it? Like, oh, you think you're going to make it, and then, again, complete rug pull. And it's that whole thing of the playoffs, isn't it, where... It all comes down to the last couple of games after a whole grueling season, and everyone's put in so much belief into it. I'd say the worst one would probably just be administration, like that period as a that period as a whole. Yeah, it's just bleak because you just didn't know if the club was going to survive. I mean, I remember chatting to my dad, and he was like, "If they go, he's like, I'm not following football anymore. Mm. I don't care." About any other club, what that would have meant to the city as well. Like if Argyle had gone, it just doesn't done by thinking about.
Yeah, I mean it's a good job that we're not here discussing any for some of Phoenix Club, or because I feel like we would have rallied around and done that sort of thing. But I agree with your earlier sentiment and the fact that Plymouth would have been filled with a lot more United and Liverpool shirts. I'd imagine even more so than before. And then obviously a slightly better one. Your top five moments.
Top five moments. It's really hard to rank them in order, but obviously, 96 playoff final. '96 playoff final. Ronnie Morge header, winning at Wembley. That's like not something many clubs get to do. Win at Wembley, so that will go in there.
It's not something that many Argyle fans get to witness, to be honest. So
no. The QPR 2-0 to go up to the championship. That game, Sparksy's infamous. That's it. Argyle are up. Yeah. Bit of commentary. Just for the pure shithousery, Peter Halmosi's goal against Leicester just after Ian Holloway had left us to go there and beat them 1-0 on telly.
Yeah, that's a great
Just for the, because I'm childish. And then I guess in equal measure, the Sturridge years and the Lowe and Schumacher years. It's hard to pick out like one particular moment, but just such a collective like effort like across the whole board, and just like from where the club had been to where it is now. Yeah, that whole sort of story arc is just incredible. If I tell you I'll end that all together, and I'll say coming out of administration as well.
Top six. We'll take it.
Yeah.
On that, just quickly then, Willie, now I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent now. I know that you said just there, and I think I said earlier in the podcast, a lot of people are now looking at it as the Lowe Schumacher years. I mean, obviously, Schumacher has by far brought us the happiest moments of that. But I think after a lot of Argyle fans were a little bit embittered, probably rightly embittered in certain ways, about the way Ryan Lowe left the club and some of the stuff he said, do you think there's now a bit of a softening where we can look back on the good stuff he did and the role he had in getting us where he did at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably quite petty to be hung up on it now. I mean, if anything, you can thank him, because I think we're probably playing like even better now under Shuey. So
Preston. Yeah, he did the best thing he did for us was bringing Stephen Schumacher to Argyle. I said those exact words.
Yeah, pretty much.
Going on to that then. So we've had the top five and the bottom five. What would be your ultimate Argyle five-a-side team of players who have played for Argyle at any time whilst you've been a fan?
It's really tough, isn't it? Goalie, especially, there's a few favourites. Just because, all right, so it was five-a-side. Down at goals, it nearly always kicked off into a fight. So I'm going to say Alan Nichols in goal, who for people of a certain age may not remember him, but he was the mercurial goalkeeper who played for us under Peter Shilton. Like England under 21, just obviously he had his personal issues and obviously died very young in a crash as well. But yeah, he should have gone to the very top. And in fact, I used to play in goal when I was in like primary school, obsessed. And then my dad's company ended up playing a cricket match against the then Argyle team the following summer after the Burnley defeat. And Alan Nichols was there and like saw me in like my little Argyle kit and stuff, and just like started battering balls at me, just said like trying to show you a bit of technique, but he did not hold back. It was like he was taking shots at a full grown adult, just absolutely pelted it. It was eye opening. So yeah, just for that alone, yeah, I love Alan Nichols.
You've got to be some goalkeeper to play under Peter Shilton though, surely. Like,
well, quite, yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, so five aside, what we're going to do? What, one defender, two mids,
up to you.
Entirely up to you. It depends. Like, I know you said you've played a bit of football. So if you were going for a five aside team, how would you set up?
All right, actual footballers. I'm going to go Curtis Nelson. Always liked him.
Solid shout.
Cultured. Yeah, big lad. But yeah, he's got good feet as well. I tell you what, right, I'll try and get a player from across each era. Up front, it has to be Mickey Evans. There you go, got the shirt there. So what we got to see, yeah, Mickey Evans, Alan Nichols, Curtis Nelson. Probably still one of my favourite Argyle players of all time. Again, that 93-94 season, Steve Castle. Who, if you haven't seen that season highlight tape, I got to find it. He scored something like 23 goals from midfield. It's just ridiculous, like Roy the Rover sort of stuff. And my fifth one's going to be Peter Halmosi. Just I think he's the best player to ever wear an Argyle shirt, and I'm going to get absolute pelters in the comments for not mentioning like Graham Carey or people like that. But it's my team, so tough luck.
Yeah, I'm sure Graham Carey would put up with being first sub with that team ahead of him, wouldn't he, I'd say?
Yeah. But then about even like Ballymumber and Morgan Whittaker now. You can feel the grease, I'm sure.
Obviously, you've named Bally and Morgan there, but how close are the current team from joining one of your like greatest Argyle XIs?
I think, yeah, Bally for me is probably, it's probably between him and Halmosi for the sort of skillful wide player. He's the sort of player like everyone talks about is like whereby people would actually like get off their seats to see what he's doing. Like, just don't know where he's gonna go next to appear next. But also just like the way he plays the game as well. Like, he just looks like he's just having the absolute time of his life every time he's on the pitch. So I think all of us wish we could be like him on the pitch. I know I do.
Obviously, this is going to go out slightly later, but say mid-December. So pretend you know how we got on in November. Do you have any worries about, you know, dropping back down to League One, or do you think we'll be absolutely fine? And
I mean, the league is so tight because, I mean, so like start of November, there was like, what, 8 points between 21st and 5th or something mad. So like any team can go on a 3-game run and look like world beaters. The league is so tight at the minute. Other than Bristol City, I don't think we've really been disgraced or blown away this season. Obviously, the Southampton game, that was disappointing, like losing to a 98th minute winner from like a Scotland international striker. Yeah, there's no real shame in that. We're in the game. The Ipswich game was a disgrace because that was an absolute blatant foul on Bundu.
Yeah.
And they go there. So if they're 10 men and 2-0 down at halftime, it's a different game. And yeah, there's so many instances where we've come really close. So I think just keep on doing what we're doing. Taking Norwich apart 6-2 as well. I mean, no one saw that coming. So it sort of shows what we're capable of. But I might not be popular for saying this. If we do go down, even if we yo-yo for a bit, but the club is still moving forward and sustaining and building the academy. And I think, yeah, just thinking more long-term, let's just not blow everything up in a panic.
Yeah, I feel like what you said earlier...
Actually, I couldn't agree more.
The administration stage, you know, and the fact that, to be honest, we're lucky we've got a club to support, never mind like back in the Championship and playing so well. But I've got full trust that everybody at the club currently will do the right thing and take us in the right direction and continue that season on season progression. So, like you said, if we go down, I'm not going to panic too much. But I still prefer to stay up, though. Still prefer that. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah, yeah. I mean we're going to finish 8th. There you go. I said it. On camera.
Is that League One?
Oh, no. Fucking hell, not.
That's one of those predictions that by mid-December could look actually really doable if we go on a good run then, or it could look really far away if we don't win till then. So we do in the interim will depend how it is. And another one to just finish up for me, and I know Aaron has one more question he wants to ask just at the end, but following Argyle on tour with Bastille, because I know that I'm sure you, as with all Argyle fans, you know, whatever you're doing on a match day, if you can't be there for whatever reason, there's a little bit of your mind that's always been on the game. Have there been any sort of weird experiences or weird stories following the Greens from Bastille, or seeing any Argyle fans from other parts of the world around about there?
So yeah, like no, like especially weird instances following Argyle. I mean, you see Argyle shirts in the strangest places. You bump into I saw an Argyle scarf up in like a sports pub in like Minnesota one time, a mid US tour. Just things coming out of nowhere. But yeah, a lot of my sort of Argyle experience whilst on tour is obviously affected by time zones. So in America, it means getting up at stupid o'clock to watch it or listen. Or if you're like in the van, or on like plain Wi-Fi or something, and you can't watch it, then it's kind of following like on Twitter and that sort of thing, just kind of constantly hitting refresh just to see what's going on. But yeah, it can be tricky at times, but I'm still obsessed as I was when I was 7.
There was a phase where I think it's safe to say you were seen constantly in it with a fresh ego kid hat on. I'm assuming that's due to your friendship with Marvin Morgan. Obviously, I believe he was a big fan, and he was like, you know, driving for a bit. It was at Plymouth Pavilion's gig. I think that's where he was there with somebody else.
He brought half a squad down. He brought Marv. I had a couple of nights out with Marv. God bless him. He was basically, for the time he was down in Plymouth, he was basically king of Plymouth. I went out with him one night, ended up in Oceania, as was. And yeah, he just sort of went in there, like knew everyone, like in behind the bar, grabbing a couple of bottles out. Just like it was basically his house. And then he also brought half the squad down to the after party for that first Pavilions gig as well. Sort of took over in Annabelle's. He was brilliant, man. But his company and like my band sort of like they sort of hit a similar trajectory like at the same sort of time. So it's just kind of nice mutual loving. It's just shocking that he's gone. Absolutely mind blowing.
Yeah, it's mad. There was a period where they were several years apart. I will add that my first ever gig was at Plymouth Pavilions watching N-Dub stood next to Bradley Wright Phillips. And then my second gig at Pavilions was yourself. Marvin was taller than most, so it was easy to spot. And I remember just knocking around near Marvin Morgan because of who he was for your gig. So they're my two experiences of the Pavilions with Bradley Wright Phillips and Marvin Morgan. But
decent players, both of them.
Yeah. But I think we'll call that a night. Appreciate you jumping on, Chris.
All good.
Been a pleasure. Thank you for coming on.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.